young, murmured the women. Without actually realizing it, they were expecting some vision from the apocalypse, some terrifying foreign monster. Since he looked around expectantly, the newsagent, who had fought in 14 and wore his croix de guerre and military medals on the inside of his old grey jacket, came out of his shop and walked towards the enemy. For a moment, the two men just stood there, face to face, without saying a word. Then the German took out a cigarette and asked for a light, in bad French. The newsagent replied in bad German. He'd been among the occupying forces in Mainz in 18. There was such total silence, the whole village was holding its breath, that you could hear each and every word. The German asked for directions. The Frenchman replied, then became bolder. Has the armistice been signed? The German threw open his arms. We don't know yet. We hope so, he said. And the humanity of his words, his gesture, everything proved they were not dealing with some bloodthirsty monster, but with a simple soldier like any other. And suddenly the ice was broken between the town and the enemy, between the country folk and the invader. It doesn't seem so bad, the women whispered. He smiled, and then, raising his hand to his helmet, made an unconfident, half-finished gesture, not quite a military salute, but not a civilian greeting either. He glanced curiously at the closed windows for a moment, started up his motorcycle, and disappeared. One after the other, doors opened, and the entire village spilled out into the square until the newsagent was surrounded. Standing motionless, his hands in his pockets, he was frowning and staring into the distance. Contradictory expressions appeared on his face. Relief it was all over, sadness and anger that it had all ended this way, memories of the past, fear of the future, and all these feelings were mirrored in the faces around him. The women dried tears from their eyes. The men stood silent, looking obstinate and hostile. The children, distracted from their games for a moment, turned back to their marbles and hopscotch. The sky was shining with the kind of brilliant, silvery light you sometimes find in the middle of a truly beautiful day. An almost imperceptible, iridescent mist hovered in the air, and all the fresh colours of June were intensified, looked richer and softer, as if reflected through a prism. The hours passed by peacefully. There were fewer cars on the road. Bicycles still sped along as if caught up in the angry wind that had been blowing in from the northeast for over a week now, dragging with them their miserable human cargo. A little while later there was a surprising sight. Cars appeared, travelling in the opposite direction from a week ago. People were going back to Paris. When they saw that, the villagers finally believed it was all over. They went home. Once again, you could hear the women rattling the dishes as they washed them in their kitchens, the faint footsteps of an old woman going to feed her rabbits, even a little girl singing as she drew water from a pump. Dogs rolled around, playing in the dust. It was an exquisite evening, with clear skies and blue shadows. The last rays of the setting sun caressed the roses, while the church bells called the faithful to prayer. But then a noise rose up from the road, a noise unlike any they'd heard these past few days, a low, steady rumbling that seemed to move slowly closer, heavy and relentless. Trucks were heading towards the village. This time it really was the Germans. The trucks stopped in the village square, and men got out. Others pulled up behind them, then more and still more. In a few seconds, the whole of the old dusty square, from the church to the municipal hall, became a dark, still mass of grey vehicles, with a few faded branches clinging to them, the remains of their camouflage. There were so many. Silently, cautiously, people came out onto their doorsteps again. They tried in vain to count the flood of soldiers. Germans were coming from all directions. They filled the squares and streets, more and more of them, endlessly. The villagers hadn't heard the sound of footsteps in the street, young voices, laughter, since September. They were stunned by the noise emerging from this wave of green uniforms, by the scent of these healthy men, their young flesh, and especially by the sound of this foreign language. Germans poured into the houses, the shops, the cafes. Their boots clanked over the red tiles of the kitchens. They asked for food, drink. They stroked the children as they went by. They threw open their arms. They sang. They laughed with the women. Their obvious happiness, their delight at being conquerors, their feverish bliss, a bliss combined with a touch of wonder, as if they themselves could hardly believe what had happened, all this contained such drama, such excitement, that the defeated villagers forgot their sadness and bitterness for a few seconds. They just stood and watched, speechless. In the little hotel, below the room where Hubert was still sleeping, the main room echoed with songs and shouting. The Germans had immediately demanded champagne. Sekt, Nahrung! And corks flew from their hands. Some of them were playing billiards. Others went into the kitchen, carrying piles of raw pink pork cutlets, which they threw onto the fire. The meat sizzled and let off thick smoke as it cooked. The soldiers brought bottles of beer up from the cellar, impatiently pushing aside the waitress who wanted to help them. A young man with a rosy complexion and a mass of golden hair was cracking eggs open on the edge of the stove. In the garden, someone else was picking the first strawberries of summer. Two half-naked young boys were dipping their heads in buckets of cold water drawn from the well. They ate their fill, gorged themselves with all the good things the gardens provided. They had cheated death. They were young, alive. They were conquerors. Their excitement spilled out in urgent, rapid chatter. They spoke bad French to anyone who would listen to them, pointing to their boots, saying over and over again, "We walking, walking, comrades falling, and we always walking." The clinking of weapons, belts, helmets filled the room. Hubert could hear it in his dream, and confusing it with his memories of the day before, imagined once more the battle on the Moulin Bridge. He tossed about, sighing and moaning as if in pain, fighting off some invisible person. When he finally woke up, he was in a strange bedroom. He'd slept all day. He could see the full moon shining through the open window. Hubert started, rubbed his eyes, and looked at the dancer who had come in while he was asleep. He muttered his thanks and apologies. "You must be hungry," she said. It was true, he was famished. "You know, perhaps it would be better if you had dinner here with me. It's unbearable downstairs. There are soldiers everywhere." "Soldiers," he said, rushing towards the door. "What are they saying? Are things looking any better? Where are the Germans?" "The Germans? But they're here. It's the German soldiers who are downstairs." He leapt away from her in surprise, as fearful as a hunted animal. "The Germans? No, you're joking." He tried in vain to find some other words, and then repeated in a low, shaky voice, "You're joking." She opened the door. The smell of thick, acrid smoke rose up from the room downstairs, along with the unmistakable sound of a group of victorious soldiers, shouting, laughter, singing, their noisy boots, the clanging of heavy guns thrown onto the marble tables, the crashing of helmets against metal belt buckles, and the joyous roar from a proud, happy crowd, intoxicated by their victory. "Like the winning team at a rugby match," Hubert thought. He found it almost impossible not to shout out insults or collapse in tears. Rushing to the window, he looked outside. The street was starting to empty, but four men were walking abreast, rapping on the doors of the houses as they passed, shouting, "Lights out!" One after the other, lights were submissively switched off. All that remained was the moonlight, which cast a dull blue glow as it shimmered off the helmets and grey gun barrels. Hubert was shaking. He grabbed the curtain with both hands, pressed it against his mouth, and burst into tears. "Ah, come on now," the woman said, stroking his shoulder and feeling mildly sorry for him. "There's nothing we can do about it, is there? What can we do? All the tears in the world won't change anything. There are better times ahead. We have to live to see the better times. First and foremost, we have to live, to go on. But you acted very bravely. If everyone had been as brave as you, and you're so young, almost a child." He shook his head. "No," she said, lowering her voice. "Are you a man, then?" She fell silent. Her fingers were trembling slightly, and she dug her nails into the boy's arm as if she were grabbing hold of some fresh prey and kneading it before biting into it to satisfy her hunger. "Don't cry," she said very quietly, her voice faltering. "Only children cry. You're a man. When a man is unhappy, he knows what he needs." She waited for a response, but he said nothing and lowered his eyes. His mouth was closed and sad, but his nose wrinkled and his nostrils quivered slightly. So she said in a very quiet voice, "Love." Chapter 20. In the room where the Perican children were sleeping, Albert the cat had made his bed. First he'd climbed onto Jacqueline's small floral quilt and started to paw at it, gnawing at the cotton fabric that smelled of glue and fruit. But Nanny had come in and chased him away. 3 times in a row, as soon as she turned away, he'd returned, with a silent, graceful leap. But finally he'd had to admit defeat, and so had curled up at the back of an armchair under Jacqueline's dressing gown. Sleep filled the room. The children were resting peacefully, and Nanny had fallen asleep while saying her rosary. The cat, absolutely still, stared intently with one green eye at the rosary, gleaming in the moonlight. The other eye remained closed. His body was hidden by the pink flannel dressing gown. Little by little, extremely quietly, one leg emerged, then the other. He stretched them out and felt them tremble slightly all the way from his shoulder joint, that steel spring hidden beneath a soft, warm fur coat, right down to his hard, transparent claws. He sprang forward, jumped onto Nanny's bed and stared at her for a long time without moving. Only the ends of his delicate whiskers quivered. He stretched one paw forward and started playing with the rosary beads. They hardly moved at first, but then he began to enjoy the smooth, cool feel of these perfect, tiny balls rolling between his claws. He swiped at them harder, and the rosary fell to the floor. The cat took fright and disappeared under an armchair. A while later, Emmanuel woke up and started crying. The windows and shutters were both open. The moon lit up the rooftops in the village. Tiles glistened like the scales on a fish. The garden was fragrant, peaceful, and the silvery light seemed to shimmer like clear water, gently rising and falling over the fruit trees. The cat poked his nose through the fringes of the armchair and studied the scene with a dreamy expression. He was a very young cat who had only ever lived in the city, where the scent of such June nights was far away. Occasionally he had caught a whiff of something warm and intoxicating, but nothing like here, where the smell rose up to his whiskers and took hold of him, making his head spin. Eyes half closed, he could feel waves of powerful sweet perfume running through him, the pungent smell of the last lilacs, the sap running through the trees, the cool, dark earth, the animals, birds, moles, mice, all the prey, the musky scent of fur, of skin, the smell of blood. His mouth gaping with longing, he jumped onto the windowsill and walked slowly along the drainpipe. This was where a strong hand had grabbed him the night before and thrown him back to Jacqueline, who was crying in bed, but he would not allow himself to be caught tonight. He eyed the distance from the drainpipe to the ground. It was an easy jump, but he appeared to want to flatter himself by exaggerating the difficulty of the leap. He balanced his hind quarters, looking fierce and confident, swept his long black tail across the drainpipe, and ears pulled back, leapt forward, landing on the freshly tilled earth. He hesitated for a moment, then buried his muzzle in the ground. Now he was in the very black of night. At the heart of it, at the darkest point. He needed to sniff the earth. Here, between the roots and the pebbles, were smells untainted by the scent of humans, smells that had yet to waft into the air and vanish. They were warm, secretive, eloquent, alive. Each and every scent meant that there was some small living creature hiding, happy, edible. June bugs, field mice, crickets, and that small toad whose voice seemed full of crystallized tears. The cat's long ears, pink triangles tinged with silver, pointed and delicately curly inside like the flower on bindweed, suddenly shot up. He was listening to faint noises in the shadows, so delicate, so mysterious, but to him alone so clear, the rustling of wisps of straw in nests where birds watch over their young, the flutter of feathers, the sound of pecking on bark, the beating of insect wings, the patter of mice gently scratching the ground, even the faint bursting of seeds opening. Golden eyes flashed by in the darkness. There were sparrows sleeping under leaves, fat blackbirds, nightingales. The male nightingales were already awake, singing to each other in the forest and along the river banks. There were other sounds as well. The steady thud of explosions, rising and bursting forth like flowers. And when the noise stopped, the rattling of every windowpane in the village. The banging of shutters being opened and closed, anxious words flying from window to window. At first, the cat had started every time he heard an explosion, his tail stiff, his fur bristling, his whiskers tense with fear. But he'd got used to the way the rumble came closer and closer, no doubt imagining it was thunder. He leapt about in the flower beds, pulled the petals off a rose with his claws. The rose was in full bloom. The slightest breeze could destroy it. Its white petals would fall to the ground like soft, sweet-smelling rain. Suddenly, as quick as a squirrel, the cat darted up a tree, ripping the bark with his claws. Terrified birds flew off. At the end of a branch, he began a savage, arrogant dance, taunting in his bold, warlike way the sky, the earth, the animals, the moon. Now and again he opened his deep, narrow mouth and let out a piercing meow, a sharp, provocative call to all the cats nearby. The birds in the henhouse and the dovecot all woke up and hid their heads beneath their wings, catching the scent of fate and death. A small white hen tentatively climbed onto a metal drinking trough, knocked it over and rushed away, making terrified screeching noises. But the cat had jumped onto the ground now. He stood motionless, waiting. His round golden eyes shone in the darkness. There was the sound of leaves rustling, and he came back, carrying a small dead bird in his mouth, his tongue slowly lapping at its wound. Eyes closed, he savoured the warm blood. He'd plunged his claws into the bird's heart and clenched and unclenched his talons, digging deeper and deeper into the tender flesh that covered its delicate bones with slow and rhythmical movements until its heart stopped beating. He ate the bird, slowly, then licked himself clean, polishing the tip of his beautiful bushy tail, which was moist and shiny from the damp night air. He was feeling benevolent now. When a shrew darted between his legs, he let it go. He was content merely to swipe at a mole's head, leaving it only half dead, a trail of blood on its muzzle. He studied the mole with a scornful trembling of his nostrils, but didn't touch it. A different kind of hunger had arisen within him. He arched his back, raised his head and meowed again, a call that ended in a harsh, imperious cry. An old red pussycat suddenly appeared on the roof of the henhouse, basking in the moonlight. The short June night was fading. The stars grew paler. The air smelled of milk and moist grass. Now, half hidden behind the forest, only the pink tip of the moon could be seen, growing dimmer and dimmer in the mist. Tired, triumphant, and covered in dew, the cat gnawed on a sprig of grass, then slipped back into Jacqueline's room, onto her bed, looking for that warm spot near her thin feet. He was purring like a kettle on the boil. A few seconds later, the arsenal exploded. Chapter 21. The arsenal exploded, and the horrible echo of the explosion had only just stopped. The air all around them shook. All the doors and windows were vibrating, and the small wall at the cemetery crumbled, when a long flame shot up, whistling from the bell tower. The noise of the incendiary bomb had merged with the explosion of the arsenal. In a second, the entire village was in flames. There was hay in the barns, straw in the lofts. Everything caught fire. Roofs caved in, floors cracked in half. The refugees rushed into the streets, while the villagers ran to open the cowsheds and stables to save the animals. The horses were neighing, rearing, terrified by the intensity of the noise and fire. They refused to come out and beat their heads and hooves against the burning walls. A cow rushed by, bellowing in pain and terror, as it frantically tried to shake a bale of burning hay from its horns. Pieces of glowing straw flew everywhere. In the garden, the blossoming trees were bathed in a red-as-blood light. Normally, the firemen would have come and people would have calmed down once the initial fear had passed. But this disaster, happening after so many others, was more than they could bear. Also, they knew the firemen had received orders to leave with all their equipment 3 days before. They felt hopeless. "If only the men were here!" cried the women. "The men!" But the men were far away, and the children were running, screaming, rushing about, causing even greater confusion. The refugees were howling in terror. Among them were the Péricans, half-dressed, faces dirty, hair dishevelled. It was the same as when the bombs had fallen on the road. Everyone was shouting at once, calling to each other, and the voices all merged into one. The village was reduced to a roar.
"Jean! Suzanne! Mummy! Grandma!"
No one replied. A few youngsters who had managed to get their bicycles out of the burning sheds pushed them violently through the crowd. Yet, oddly enough, everyone believed that they were remaining calm, that they were behaving exactly as they should. Madame Péricon was holding Emmanuel in her arms. Jacqueline and Bernard were clutching her skirt. Jacqueline had even managed to get the cat back into his basket when her mother had pulled her out of bed, and she now gripped it tightly to her.
"The most precious things have been saved," Madame Péricon said to herself over and over again. "Thank you, God."
Her jewellery and money were sewn into a suede pouch pinned inside her blouse, and she could feel it against her chest as she ran. She'd had the presence of mind to grab her fur coat and the small overnight case full of the family silver, which she'd kept beside her bed. She had her children, her three children. Sometimes a thought shot through her, as sharp and rapid as lightning, of her two older sons in danger, far away, Philippe and that mad Hubert. She'd been desperate when Hubert ran away, yet rather proud of him. His behaviour had been irrational, wild, but manly. For them, Philippe and Hubert, she could do nothing. But her three little ones, she had saved her three little ones. She was sure she'd had a premonition the night before. She'd put them to bed, half-dressed. Jacqueline didn't have a dress on, but a jacket covered her naked shoulders. She wouldn't be cold. It was better than wearing just a blouse. The baby was wrapped up in a blanket. Bernard even had his beret on. She herself had no stockings, just red slippers on her bare feet, but gritting her teeth, arms tight round the baby, who wasn't crying, but whose eyes were rolling wildly with fear, she made her way through the panic-stricken crowd without the slightest idea where she was going. The sky above seemed filled with countless planes. There were two, flying back and forth with their evil buzzing like hornets. "Please don't let them bomb us any more. Please don't let them bomb us any more. Please..." These words went round and round endlessly in her bowed head. Out loud, she said,
"Don't let go of my hand, Jacqueline. Bernard, stop crying. You're behaving like a girl."
"There, there, baby, don't worry. Mummy's here." She said these words mechanically, while silently continuing to pray, "Please don't let them bomb us any more. Let them bomb anyone else, dear God, but not us. I have three children. I have to save them. Please don't let them bomb us any more."
They finally made it out of the narrow village street. She was in the open countryside. The fire was behind her. The flames fanned out across the sky. Scarcely an hour had passed since dawn, when the bomb had struck the bell tower. They were passed by car upon car fleeing Paris, Dijon, Normandy, the Lorraine region, France itself. The people inside them were numb. Sometimes they raised their heads to look at the fire in the distance, but their faces were indifferent. They had seen so many things. Nanny was walking behind Madame Péricon. She seemed mute with terror. Her lips were moving, but she made no sound. She was holding her fluted bonnet with its cotton ties, newly ironed.
Madame Pericon looked at her indignantly. Really, Nanny, couldn't you have found something more useful to bring? Honestly.
The old woman made an extraordinary effort to speak. She went red in the face, her eyes filled with tears.
Good Lord, thought Madame Pericon, now she's going mad, whatever will I do?
But the harsh voice of her mistress had miraculously returned the gift of speech to Nanny. She replied in her usual tone of voice, simultaneously respectful and bitter.
Madame didn't think I would leave it behind. It's valuable.
This bonnet was a bone of contention between them. Nanny hated the hats she was forced to wear. So suitable, Madame Pericon thought, so appropriate for a servant, for she felt that each social class should wear some sign indicative of their station to avoid any misconceptions, just as shops displayed price tags.
You can tell it's not her who does the washing and ironing, nasty old bag, Nanny would say as she worked.
Her hands trembling, she put the lace butterfly of a bonnet on over the enormous nightcap she was already wearing. Madame Pericon looked at her, thought there was something odd about her, but couldn't say exactly what it was. Everything seemed incredible. The world was a horrible dream. She dropped down onto the verge, put Emmanuel back into Nanny's arms, and said as vehemently as possible,
"Now we have to get out of here!"
And remained on the ground, waiting for some miracle. There was none. But a donkey pulling a cart passed by. When she saw the driver slow down at the sight of her and her children, Madame Pericon's intuition took over, the intuition innate to the wealthy, who can always tell when and where something can be bought.
Stop!
Madame Pericon shouted.
Where's the nearest railway station?
Saint-Georges.
How long would it take you to get there with your donkey?
Well, about 4 hours.
Are the trains still running?
I've heard they are.
Good. I'm getting in. Come on, Bernard. Nanny, bring the baby.
But, madame, I wasn't going that way, and what with going and coming back, that'll be at least 8 hours.
You'll be well paid, said Madame Pericon.
She climbed into the carriage, calculating that if the trains were running normally, she would be in Nîmes the next morning. Nîmes, her mother's dear old house, her bedroom, a bath. She nearly fainted at the thought. Would there be enough room for her on the train? With 3 children, she said to herself, I'm sure to manage it. Because of her position, as the mother of a large family, Madame Pericon was usually treated like royalty and came first wherever she was. Nor was she the kind of woman who allowed anyone to forget what was rightfully hers. She crossed her arms and studied the countryside victoriously.
But, madame, what about the car? Nanny moaned. It'll be reduced to ashes by now, replied Madame Pericon. What about the trunks, the children's things?
The trunks had been loaded onto the servant's van. Only 3 suitcases were left by the time disaster struck. 3 suitcases full of linen.
I just have to do without them, Madame Pericon sighed,
looking up at the sky, picturing once more, as in a wonderful dream, the deep wardrobes in Nîmes with their treasured cambric and linen.
Nanny, who had lost her big trunk with the metal bands and an imitation pigskin handbag, began to cry.
Madame Pericon tried in vain to make her see how ungrateful she was being towards Providence.
Remember that you are alive, my dear Nanny. Nothing else matters.
The donkey trotted on. The farmer took small side roads thick with refugees. At 11 o'clock, they arrived at Saint-Georges, and Madame Pericon managed to get on a train heading in the direction of Nîmes. Everyone around her was saying the armistice had been signed.
Impossible, some said.
Nevertheless, there was no more gunfire, no bombs were falling.
Could this nightmare finally be over? Thought Madame Pericon.
She looked again at everything she had brought, everything she had saved. Her children, her overnight case. She placed her hand over the jewellery and money sewn into her blouse.
Yes, during this terrible time, she had acted with determination, courage, and composure. She hadn't lost her head. Suddenly she cried out in a choked voice. She clutched her throat and fell backwards, letting out a low moan as if she was suffocating. My God, madame, madame, what's the matter? Exclaimed Nanny. Nanny! My dear Nanny,
Madame Pericon finally groaned in a barely audible voice.
We forgot.
What? What did we forget?
We forgot my father-in-law, said Madame Perricon, dissolving into tears.
Chapter 22. Charles Langelet had driven all night long from Paris to Montargis, and so had shared in the general misfortune. Nevertheless, he demonstrated great strength of character. In the hostelry where he stopped for lunch, the groups of refugees around him were complaining about the horrors they had encountered on the journey. They looked to him for confirmation, saying, "Isn't that so, monsieur? You saw it too, didn't you? No one can accuse us of exaggerating." But he merely replied, dryly, "I didn't see anything."
"What? No bombs?" asked the surprised owner.
"No, madame."
"No fires?"
"Not even a traffic accident."
"Well, lucky you,"
the woman said, after thinking for a moment and shrugging her shoulders doubtfully as if to say, "He's peculiar." Langelet took a bite of the omelette he'd just been served, pushed it away, mumbling, "Inedible," asked for his bill and left. He got a kind of perverse pleasure from depriving these good souls of the satisfaction they hoped to attain by questioning him, for they, vulgar, vile creatures that they were, imagined they were feeling compassion for all mankind, while in reality they were merely thrilled by base, melodramatic curiosity.
"It's unbelievable how much vulgarity there is," Charles Langelet thought sadly.
He was always pained and scandalized when he encountered the real world, full of unfortunate people who had never seen a cathedral, a statue, a painting. What was more, the happy few, among whom he flattered himself he belonged, displayed the same spinelessness, the same stupidity in the face of misfortune, as these common types. Lord, just think of what these people would make of this exodus, their exodus, later on. He could just hear them.
"I wasn't afraid of the Germans, not me," an old bag would whine. "I went straight up to them and said, 'This house belongs to the mother of a French officer,' and they didn't say a word." And another woman would say, "Bullets were flying all around me, but it's funny, I wasn't scared, not a bit." It was understood that everyone would embellish their tales with terrifying scenes. As for Charles, he would simply reply, "That's odd. Everything seemed quite normal to me. There were a lot of people on the road, but that's all."
He imagined their surprise and smiled, feeling smug. He needed to feel smug. When he thought about his apartment in Paris, his heart broke. Now and again he turned round towards the back of the car to look lovingly at the crates containing his porcelain, his greatest treasures. There was a Capodimonte group he was worried about. He wondered if he put enough wood shavings and tissue paper round it. There wasn't much tissue paper left by the time he'd finished wrapping everything. It was a centrepiece for a table, young women dancing with cupids and fauns. He sighed. In his mind, he thought of himself as a Roman fleeing the lava and ash of Pompeii, abandoning his slaves, his house, his gold, but taking with him, in the folds of his tunic, some terracotta figurine, a perfectly shaped vase, or a bowl modelled on a beautiful breast. He felt simultaneously comforted and bitter at being so different from other people. He looked out at them with his pale eyes. The wave of cars was still moving, and all the anxious, sombre faces were the same. What a sad breed! What were they thinking about? What they would eat, what they would drink? He was thinking about the cathedral in Rouen, the chateaus of the Loire, the Louvre. A single one of those venerable stones was worth more than 1,000 human lives. He was approaching Jean. A black spot appeared in the sky. In a flash, he realized that the stream of refugees near the level crossing would be a sitting target for an enemy plane, so he pulled off onto a side road. 15 minutes later, there was a crash only a few meters away from him. Other cars, also trying to avoid the main road, collided with each other when a terrified driver took a wrong turn. They rebounded off each other into the fields, shedding luggage, mattresses, birdcages, injured women. Charlie heard confused sounds, but didn't turn round. He headed at full speed towards a thick wood. There he stopped his car, waited a moment, then set off again through the countryside. The main highway was clearly becoming too dangerous. He stopped thinking about the dangers the Rouen Cathedral might face for a moment to imagine very precisely what was threatening him, Charles Langelet. He didn't want to dwell on it, but the most unpleasant images filled his mind. His large, delicate, slim hands clenched the steering wheel, trembling slightly. There were few cars and houses where he was, and he had no idea where he was going. He'd always had a bad sense of direction. He wasn't used to travelling without a chauffeur. For a while he got lost in the outskirts of Jeanne, becoming ever more agitated for fear he might run out of petrol. He sighed and shook his head. He had predicted what would happen. He, Charles Langelet, was not made for this uncouth existence. The thousand little pitfalls of daily life were too much for him. The car stopped. Out of petrol. He made a small, gracious gesture to himself, as one bows before the inevitable. There was nothing to be done. He would have to spend the night in the woods.
"You wouldn't possibly have a can of petrol you could let me have?"
he asked a passing driver. The man said no, and Charlie smiled, depressed and bitter.
"Well, that's the human race for you, egotistical and mean. In times of misfortune, no one will share with his brother, not a crust of bread, not a bottle of beer, not a pathetic little can of petrol."
The driver turned round and shouted at him,
"There's some about 10 kilometres from here, in—"
The name of the hamlet was lost as he drove off, but Charlie had already started to walk towards the trees. He thought he could make out one or two houses. "But what about the car? I can't leave the car," Charlie said to himself in despair.
"Let's try to start it again."
Nothing happened. He was covered with dust as thick as chalk. A car was slowly making its way towards him. It was jammed with young people, some even clinging to the running board and the roof like flies. They seemed drunk.
"What a bunch of louts,"
Langelet thought, shuddering. Nevertheless, he spoke to them in his most pleasant voice.
"You gentlemen wouldn't happen to have a drop of petrol. I'm stuck."
They stopped with a horrible screeching of overworked brakes, looked at Charlie and sniggered.
"What's it worth?"
one of them finally said. Charlie knew very well he should have replied,
"However much you want,"
but he was mean. And moreover, he was afraid these tramps would be tempted to rob him if they thought he was too rich. Truth be told, he was terrified of being duped.
"I'd pay a reasonable price," he replied haughtily. "There ain't none,"
said the driver of the jerky, creaking car, and drove off along the sandy road through the forest, while Langelet, beside himself, waved his arms about and shouted at him.
"Wait a minute, wait! Stop! At least tell me how much you want!"
They didn't even reply. He was alone. But not for long, for night was falling and refugees were gradually coming into the forest. They hadn't been able to find rooms in a hotel. Even the private houses were completely full. So they had decided to spend the night in the woods. Soon it was just like a July campsite in Elisabethville, Langelet thought, feeling sick to his stomach. Children were squealing, the mossy ground was littered with discarded newspaper, dirty clothes and empty tins of food. Some of the women were crying, others were shouting or laughing. Horrible, filthy children came up to Charles, who chased them away by rolling his eyes at them angrily, but without raising his voice, for he didn't want any trouble from their parents. "They're the dregs of the dregs from Belleville," he mumbled, horrified.
"How did I end up here?"
A chance brought him, together with the inhabitants of one of the worst neighbourhoods in Paris? Or had Charlie's vivid, anxious imagination got the better of him? All the men looked like bandits, the women like con artists. Soon it was completely dark, and beneath the thick trees the translucent shadows of a June night were transformed into black shade interspersed with silver glades, drenched in moonlight. Every sound echoed, distinct and sinister. The planes flying across the sky, the night birds, the distant explosions, either gunfire or tires bursting, you couldn't be sure. Once or twice a prowler stared at Charles maliciously. He heard things that made him shudder. People weren't thinking straight. They kept talking about rich people who'd run away to save their skins and their money, jamming up the roads, while poor people had only their own two legs and had to walk till they dropped down exhausted. Well, they're not those poor people. They've got cars, Charlie thought, outraged.
and stolen, no doubt.
He was extremely relieved when a little car pulled up next to him with a young man and woman who were clearly a better class of people than the other refugees. The young man's arm was slightly deformed. He held it in front of him ostentatiously, as if it carried a sign in big letters which read, "Unfit for military service." The woman was young, pretty, and very fair. They shared some sandwiches, and soon fell asleep in the front of the car, leaning against each other, cheek to cheek. Charlie tried to sleep as well, but fatigue, overexcitement, fear kept him awake. An hour later, the young man in the car opened his eyes, gently disentangled himself from the young woman, and lit a cigarette. He saw that L'Angelet was also awake.
"This is so bad," he said quietly, leaning towards him.
"Yes, it's very bad."
"Well, the night will go by fast. I hope to make it to Beaugency tomorrow by taking the side roads, because the main road down there is impossible."
"Really? And it seems there's been some heavy bombing, too."
"Well, you're lucky," Charlie said. "I haven't got a drop of petrol left."
He paused.
"If I could impose on you to watch my car for a while..." He really does seem like an honest person, he thought. "I could go to the next village, where I heard I could get some."
The young man shook his head. "Unfortunately, monsieur, there's none left. I bought the last cans, and at an outrageous price." He pointed to the petrol cans tied to the back of the car. "I have just enough to get to the Loire and cross the bridges before they're blown up."
"What? They're going to blow up all the bridges?"
"That's what everyone's saying. They're going to fight along the Loire."
"So you think there's no petrol at all?"
"Oh, I'm sure of it. I would have been glad to let you have some, but I only have just enough for myself. I have to get my fiancée to safety at her parents' house. They live in Bergerac. Once we've crossed the Loire, it'll be easy to find petrol, I hope."
"Oh, so she's your fiancée," Charlie said, while thinking of other things.
"Yes, we were supposed to get married on the 14th of June. Everything was arranged, the invitations were sent, the rings bought. The dress was supposed to be delivered tomorrow morning." He drifted off into deep thought.
"It's just a delay," Charles L'Angelet said politely.
"Who knows where we'll be tomorrow, monsieur? Obviously I shouldn't complain. At my age I should have been in the army, but with my arm. Yes, an accident at school, but I think that in this war civilians are facing more danger than the soldiers. They say that certain towns," he lowered his voice, "are in ashes, and piled high with bodies, and there are mass graves. And I've heard some horrifying stories. You know that they've let everyone out of the prisons and insane asylums."
"Yes, they have, monsieur. Our leaders have lost their minds. Prisoners are running loose without wardens. I heard that the director of one of these prisons was murdered by the inmates he was ordered to evacuate. It happened right near here. I've seen it with my own eyes. Private houses turned upside down, pillaged. And they attack people who are travelling. They steal from people in cars."
"Oh, they steal from..."
"We'll never know everything that happened during the exodus. Now they're saying you should have stayed at home.
Oh, that's nice of them. So we could get massacred in our own homes by the artillery and planes.
I'd rented a small house in Montfort-l'Amaurie to have a lovely month after our wedding before going back to my in-laws. It was destroyed on the 3rd of June, monsieur," he said indignantly. He talked a lot and feverishly. He looked exhausted. He touched his fiancée's cheek tenderly as she slept.
"I just want to save Solange."
"You're both very young, aren't you?"
"I'm 22 and Solange is 20.
"She's not very comfortable like that,"
Charles L'Angelet said suddenly, sweetly, in a voice even he himself didn't recognise, as sweet as sugar, while his heart beat harder and faster.
"Why don't you both go and stretch out on the grass over there?"
"What about the car?"
"Oh, I'll watch the car, don't worry," Charlie said, trying not to laugh.
The young man still hesitated.
"I want to leave as early as possible, and I sleep so soundly."
"But I'll wake you up. What time do you want to leave?" "Look, it's nearly midnight," he said, consulting his watch. "I'll call you at 4 o'clock.
"Oh, monsieur, you are too kind."
"Not at all. When I was 22, I was also in love."
The young man made a confused gesture.
"We were supposed to get married on the 14th of June.
he repeated, sighing.
Yes, of course, of course. We are living through terrible times, but I assure you it's ridiculous to stay cramped in your car. Your fiancé is all bent up. Do you have a blanket?
My fiancé has a big travelling coat.
It's so nice on the grass. If I didn't have to worry about my rheumatism. Oh, you're so lucky to be a young man of 20.
The fiancé corrected him. 22.
You will see better times. You will always find a way out. You will. While a poor old gentleman like me...
He lowered his eyes, like a cat when it purrs. Then he stretched out his hand towards a moonlit clearing, just visible between the trees.
It must be so nice over there. You could forget everything.
He waited, then whispered in a falsely nonchalant tone of voice,
Can you hear that nightingale?
The bird had been singing for some time, perched high on a branch, indifferent to the noise, the refugees complaining, the large fires they'd lit on the grass to chase away the damp. The bird sang, and other nightingales in the countryside answered his song. The young man listened to the bird, tilting his head, and he put his arm round his sleeping fiancée. A few moments later he whispered something in her ear. She opened her eyes. He whispered to her again, closer, urging her. Charlie turned away. Nevertheless, he could hear certain words.
Since this gentleman said he'd watch the car, and... You don't love me, Solange. No, you don't. And yet you...
Charlie yawned loudly, obviously, and addressing no one in particular, with the exaggerated ease of a bad actor, said,
I think I'll go to sleep now.
Solange stopped hesitating. She giggled nervously, pushing her fiancé away, only to give in and kiss him, saying,
If Mummy could see us now! Oh, Bob, you're terrible! You won't hold it against me afterwards, will you, Bob?
She walked away with her fiancé's arm around her. Charlie saw them beneath the trees, holding each other and exchanging little kisses. Then they disappeared from sight. He waited. The half hour that followed seemed the longest of his life, but he was determined. He felt both anguish and extraordinary pleasure at the same time. His heart beat so violently, so painfully, that he muttered, Oh, this heart of mine, can't take it. But he knew he had never felt such exquisite pleasure. A cat who sleeps on velvet cushions and is fed on chicken breasts and suddenly finds himself in the middle of the countryside, on the dry branch of a tree wet with dew, sinking his teeth into a trembling, bleeding bird, must feel the same terror, the same cruel joy, he thought. For he was too intelligent not to understand what was happening to him. Quietly, ever so quietly, taking great care not to make any noise with the doors, he climbed into the car next to his, untied the petrol cans, he also took some oil, cut his hands, getting the cap off his tank, poured in the petrol, and taking advantage of a moment when several other cars started their motors, drove off. Once out of the forest, he turned round, smiled up at the trees, silvery green beneath the moon, and thought, They will indeed have been married on the 14th of June, after all.
Chapter 23 The uproar in the streets woke the elder Monsieur Perricon. He opened one pale eye, just one, in confusion and reproach.
What on earth are they shouting about?
He thought. He had forgotten the journey, the Germans, the war. He thought he was at his son's home in Boulevard de l'Essert, even though he was staring at a strange room. He didn't understand a thing. He was at an age when the past was more real than the present. He pictured the green cover on his bed in Paris. He stretched his shaking fingers towards the bedside table, where every morning some attentive person would put out a tray with porridge and his special biscuits. There was no tray, no bowl, not even a table. It was then that he heard the fire roaring in the neighbouring houses, smelled the smoke, and guessed what was happening. He opened his mouth, gasped silently like a fish out of water, and fainted. Yet the house hadn't burned to the ground. Only a part of the roof had been destroyed. After a great deal of panic and chaos, the flames died down. Amid the wreckage, the fire smouldered and sizzled quietly, but the house was intact, and towards evening they discovered the elder Monsieur Perricon alone in his bed. He was muttering, confused. He calmly let them take him to the nursing home.
"He'll be better off there. I've got no time to take care of him. Imagine the idea," said the owner. "What with the refugees, the Germans about to march in, and the fire and all..."
But she said nothing about what was worrying her most. Her husband and two sons gone, all three called up and missing, all three away in that vaguely defined, ever-changing, terrifyingly imminent place called the war. The nursing home was very clean, very well looked after by the Sisters of the Sacred Sacrament. They put Monsieur Perricon in a bed next to a window. He would be able to see the tall green June trees outside, and the 15 old people around him, silent and calm, in their white sheets. But he saw nothing. He thought he was still at home. Now and again he seemed to talk to his weak purplish hands, folded on top of the grey blanket. He would utter a few harsh, broken words to them, then slowly shake his head, and out of breath, close his eyes. The flames hadn't touched him, he hadn't been wounded, but he had a very high fever. The doctor was in the next village, tending to the victims of the bombing. Late that evening, he was finally able to examine Monsieur Perricon. He didn't say much. He was staggering with exhaustion, for he had cared for 60 wounded and hadn't slept in 48 hours. He gave him an injection and promised to come back the next day. To the sisters, there was no question. They had enough experience with the dying to recognize death by a sigh, a whimper, drops of cold sweat, motionless fingers. They sent someone to get the priest, who had been with the doctor in town and hadn't slept either. He gave Monsieur Perricon the last rites, and the old man seemed to come round. As he left, the priest told the sisters that the poor old gentleman had made his peace with God and would die a very Christian death. One of the sisters was small and thin, with deep blue mischievous eyes that sparkled with courage from beneath her white wimple. The other was sweet and shy, with red cheeks and a terrible toothache, which caused her to bring her hand to her painful gums now and again in the middle of saying her rosary, smiling humbly, as if she were ashamed that the cross she had to bear was so light during these terrible times. It was to her that Monsieur Perricon suddenly said — it was just after midnight, and the commotion of the day had died down, now all you could hear were the cats howling in the convent garden — "Daughter, I'm not well. Go and get the notary." He thought she was his daughter-in-law. In his delirium, he was very surprised that she'd put on a wimple to nurse him, but nevertheless it could only be her. He repeated quietly, patiently, "Monsieur Nogaret, notary, last will." "What should we do?" said Sister Marie of the Sacred Sacrament to Sister Marie of the Cherubin. The two white wimples tilted towards each other, almost meeting above Monsieur Perricon in his bed. "The notary won't come out at this hour, my poor dear. Go to sleep. There'll be time enough tomorrow."
"No, no time," the quiet voice said. "Monsieur Nogaret will come. Telephone him, please."
Once again the nuns conferred, and one of them disappeared, then came back carrying some hot herbal tea. He tried to take a few sips, but spat it out immediately. It ran down his white beard. Suddenly he became extremely agitated. He was groaning, shouting orders.
"Tell him to hurry. He promised as soon as I called. Please, hurry, Jeanne."
He no longer thought he was talking to his daughter-in-law, but to his wife, who had been dead for 40 years. A particularly sharp pain from her bad tooth prevented Sister Marie of the Sacred Sacrament from protesting. She nodded, "Yes, all right," but remained where she was, dabbing her cheek with her handkerchief. Her friend stood up decisively. "We have to get the notary, sister." She was passionate, with a natural fighting spirit, and her forced inactivity was frustrating. She'd wanted to go to the town with the doctor and priest, but couldn't leave the 15 old people at the nursing home. She didn't have much faith in the leadership qualities of Sister Marie of the Sacred Sacrament. When the fire had started, she had trembled beneath her wimple. Nevertheless, she had managed to roll the 15 beds out of the room and prepare ladders, ropes, and buckets of water. The fire had not reached the nursing home, which was 2 kilometres away from the bombed church, but she had waited, flinching at the screams from the frightened crowd, the smell of smoke, the sight of flames, fixed to her post and ready for anything. But nothing happened. The disaster victims were treated at the hospital. There was nothing to do but make soup for the 15 old people. Until the sudden arrival of Monsieur Perricon galvanized her once more. We have to go.
Do you think so, sister? He might have some important last wishes to set down. But what if Maître Charbeuf isn't at home?
Sister Marie of the Cherubins shrugged her shoulders. At 12:30, he won't want to come.
That'll be the day, the young nun said indignantly. It's his duty to come. I'll pull him out of bed myself if I have to.
She went out, but hesitated on the doorstep. The religious community, which consisted of 4 nuns, 2 of whom had gone into retreat at the convent of Paray-le-Monial at the beginning of June and still hadn't been able to return, owned a single bicycle. Up until now, none of the sisters had dared use it, afraid of causing a scandal in the village. Sister Marie the Cherubin herself had said, "We must wait until the good Lord himself provides an emergency. For example, a sick person is dying and we have to get the doctor and the priest. Every second is precious. I jump on my bicycle. No one would dare say a word. And the next time I do it, they won't even notice." They hadn't yet had an emergency, but Sister Marie the Cherubin was longing to ride that bicycle. 5 years ago, before she became a nun, she'd had so many happy outings with her sisters, so many races, so many picnics. She threw back her black veil, said to herself, "It's now or never," and her heart pounding with joy, grabbed the handlebars. Within a few minutes, she was in the village. She had some difficulty waking Maître Charbeuf, who was a sound sleeper, and even more trouble persuading him he had to come to the nursing home right away. Maître Charbeuf, whom the local girls called Big Baby because of his chubby pink cheeks and full lips, had an easygoing nature and a wife who terrified him. He got dressed, sighing, and headed for the nursing home. He found Monsieur Perricon wide awake, very red and burning with fever.
"Here's the notary," the nun said. Sit down," said the old man. "There's no time to lose."
The notary asked the nursing home's gardener and 3 sons to act as witnesses. Seeing that Monsieur Perricon was in a hurry, he took some paper out of his pocket and prepared to start writing.
"I'm ready, monsieur. If you would please, first tell me your surname, Christian names, and title."
"You're not Nogaret?"
Perricon came back to his senses. He glanced at the nursing home's walls, at the plaster statue of St. Joseph opposite his bed, at the 2 amazing roses Sister Marie of the Cherubins had picked from the window box and put into a slim blue vase. He tried to work out where he was and why he was alone, but gave up. He was dying, there it was, and he wished to have a proper death. This final act, this death, this will, how many times had he imagined them, the final, brilliant performance of a Perricon Maltette on this earth? For 10 years he had been nothing more than a pitiful old man who needed someone else to dress him and wipe his nose, and now, suddenly, he could reclaim his rightful place to punish, reward, disappoint, delight, distribute his worldly goods according to his own wishes, to control everyone, to influence everyone, to come first. Afterwards, there would be a ceremony in which he would indeed come first, in a black coffin on a raised platform with flowers. But he would be there only symbolically, or as a winged spirit, while here, once more, he was alive.
"What is your name?" he asked quietly.
"Maître Charbeuf," the notary said unassumingly.
"All right, it doesn't matter. Let's get on with it."
He began dictating, slowly, with difficulty, as if he were reading sentences written for himself and visible only to him.
"Before Maître Charbeuf, notary at..." "And in the presence of," mumbled the notary, "Monsieur Perricon in person..."
Monsieur Perricon made a feeble attempt at saying his name louder to emphasize its importance, but had to pause for breath, making it impossible for him to enunciate the prestigious syllables individually. His purple hands fluttered for a moment over the sheets, like puppets. He thought he was writing thick black marks on white paper, as he had in the past, when he signed cards, bonds, sales documents, contracts. Perican. Perican. Louis Auguste. Residing at
18 Boulevard de l'Essert, Paris.
In ill health, but sound of mind, he comes before the notary and witnesses, said Charbeuf, glancing up at the sick man and looking doubtful. He was overwhelmed by this dying man. He was fairly experienced. His clients were mainly local farmers, but all rich men make their wills the same way. This was a rich man, there was no doubt about it. Even though he was wearing one of the nursing home's coarse nightshirts, it was clear he was someone important. To be of service like this to him on his deathbed, Maître Charbeuf felt honoured. "Do you wish, monsieur, to name your son as sole beneficiary?"
"Yes. I bequeath all my worldly goods and possessions to Adrien Perican, with instructions for him to deposit immediately and without delay 5 million to the charitable institution I founded, known as the Penitent Children of the 16th Arrondissement. This institution is instructed to commission an excellent artist to paint a life-size portrait of me on my deathbed, or to sculpt a bust that is a good likeness of me, and to place it in the entrance hall of the aforementioned establishment. To my dearly beloved sister, Adèle Emilienne Louise, to compensate her for the feud caused by the inheritance left me by our venerable mother, Henriette Maltette, I do bequeath as hers and hers alone the property I own in Dunkerque, bought in 1912 with all its existing buildings and that portion of the docks which also belongs to me. I entrust my son with the responsibility of carrying out this wish. I desire that my chateau in Bléauville in the Varanges region in Calvados be turned into a home for former soldiers severely wounded in the war, preferably for those who have been paralyzed or have suffered mental breakdowns. I desire that a simple plaque be displayed on the wall, inscribed with the words, Perican Maltette, Charitable Institution, in memory of his two sons killed in Champagne. When the war is over, I think it is over, Maître Charbeuf shyly interjected. But he didn't realize that Monsieur Perican was thinking about the last war, the one that had taken two sons from him and tripled his fortune. He was back in September 1918, just after their victory, when he had nearly died of a bout of pneumonia, and when, in the presence of his family gathered at his bedside, all the relatives from the north and south had rushed to be there when they heard the news, he had performed what turned out to be a rehearsal of his death. He had dictated his last wishes then, and they had remained intact within him until now, when he could give them life. "When the war is over, I wish a monument to be built to honour the dead, for which I bequeath the sum of 3,000 francs to be taken from my estate and to be erected on the town square in Bléauville. At the top, in large gold letters, the names of my two oldest sons, then a space, then," he closed his eyes, exhausted, "then all the other names in small letters." He was silent for such a long time that the notary looked anxiously at the sisters. Was it all over already? But Sister Marie of the Cherubins calmly shook her head. He wasn't dead yet. He was thinking. In his motionless body, his memory was travelling through immense spans of time and space. "Almost all of my fortune is tied up in American stocks and bonds, which I was advised would be a good investment. I don't believe it any more," he shook his beard mournfully. "I don't believe it any more. I wish my son to convert them immediately into French francs. There is also some gold, but is not worth keeping. It should be sold. A copy of my portrait should also be placed in the chateau in Bléauville in the downstairs ballroom. I bequeath to my faithful valet an annual income of 1,000 francs for the rest of his life. As for my future great-grandchildren, I wish their parents to name the boys Louis-Auguste and the girls Louise-Augustine after me.
Is that everything? Maître Charbeuf asked. He bowed his long beard, indicating yes, that was everything. For a few moments that seemed brief to the notary, the witnesses and the sisters, but to him were as long as a century, as long as delirium, as long as a dream, Monsieur Perrican Maltet moved back in time to recall the life he had been given on this earth. The family dinners, the Boulevard de l'Essert, naps in the drawing-room, Albert the cat on his lap. The last time he saw his older brother when they had parted, vowing never to have anything more to do with each other, and he had secretly bought back the shares in that deal. Jeanne, his wife in Bléauville, hunched up with rheumatism, lying on a cane chaise longue in the garden, holding a paper fan. She died a week later. And Jeanne, in Bléauville, 35 years earlier, just after their wedding, when some bees had come in through the open window and were gathering pollen from the lilies in her bridal bouquet, and the garland of orange blossom thrown at the foot of the bed, Jeanne had rushed into his arms, laughing so he could protect her. Then he was certain he could feel death approaching. He made a startled little gesture, as if he were trying to get through a door that was too narrow for him, saying, "No, please, after you." And a look of surprise appeared on his face. "Is this what it is?" he seemed to say. "So this is death, then." The surprise on his face faded, and he looked stern, solemn. Maître Charbeuf wrote very quickly. When the testator was handed the pen to affix his signature to this last will and testament, he tried to lift his head but could not, and immediately breathed his last in the presence of the notary and the witnesses, who nevertheless, after reading the document, signed their names to render the document legal.
Chapter 24. Jean-Marie, meanwhile, was starting to come round. He had drifted in and out of sleep for 4 days, semi-conscious and feverish. It was only today he felt a bit stronger. A doctor had been able to come the night before to change the dressing. His temperature had dropped. From where he was lying on the bed, he could see a large, dark kitchen, the white hat on an old woman who was sitting in the corner, beautifully shiny pots on the wall, and a calendar depicting a chubby-cheeked French soldier hugging 2 young women from Alsace, a souvenir of the previous war. It was strange to see how the memories of the last war were still so alive in this house. 4 pictures of men in uniform had pride of place. A small tricolour ribbon and a crepe rosetta were pinned up in a corner. And next to him, to keep him from getting bored during the long hours of his convalescence, was a collection of the 1914-18 editions of L'Illustration, bound in green and black. He kept overhearing the same phrases in the conversations around him. Verdun, Charleroi, the Marne. During the other war, when I was part of the occupying forces in Mulhouse. They hardly spoke about the present war, their defeat. It was something they couldn't quite believe yet, something that would only become a living horror.